Welcome to the debate. Today is Sunday, May 31, 2026, and we are unpacking a really provocative new academic white paper.
Yeah, it's titled Life Coherent Jurisprudence by Dr. Bishara Sehaly. And it tackles some massive concepts.
It really does. And to frame this, think about looking at a highly detailed map of a city. You know, what you see is this environment of profound mathematical clarity.
Right.
You see property boundaries laid out in perfect grids, zoning districts colored in clean pastels, highway routes cutting these efficient lines across the topography. It is an incredibly powerful tool because it is, well, entirely legible.
Exactly. And it's that legibility that allows a complex society to actually function. I mean, you can plan infrastructure using that map, you can issue deeds, calculate distances, organize a tax base.
Mm-hmm.
It lets you coordinate the movement of millions of people who will never actually meet each other. It gives us a shared reality.
It does. But here is the fundamental problem. A map does not bleed when you pave over a wetland. It doesn't starve when a red line severs a community from its food supply. A map feels no grief.
Well, no, of course not. It's a representation.
Right. But Dr. Sehaly's paper asks a pretty terrifying question. Have we mistaken the legal map for the living territory? Specifically, he argues that our modern legal framework has drifted into this pathological great inversion, where abstractions like money, property, and debt have basically become the masters over human life and ecology.
And the alternative perspective, which I'm going to be defending today, asks whether those very legal abstractions, while obviously flawed and, you know, in need of calibration, are actually the essential, scalable evolutionary adaptations that successfully coordinate complex human civilization.
So my position, drawing directly on the paper's framework, is that modern law has become fundamentally life-blind. By protecting abstract symbols over living relationships, it has inverted the natural order, and we urgently need to reorient it to serve what the paper calls the life ground.
And my counterposition is that the abstraction of law into money value and formal rights is a necessary objective mechanism. It is, frankly, what rescues humanity from the arbitrary exclusionary constraints of localized customary orders.
Let's start by just unpacking the core premise of the paper, because it sets up this entire tension. The fundamental idea is simple but profound. Life came before law.
Right. Biological reality precedes legal reality.
Exactly. Long before we had courts or constitutions, living beings existed in deep ecological organism niche relations. And early human communities conserved themselves through a very specific sequence of behaviors. The paper calls this life sequencing.
And it flows logically, right?
Right. First, there's a biological need, which creates a relation, which forms an obligation, leading to restraint, then sharing, repair, and finally, continuity.
It makes intuitive sense. You see a need. Say, someone in your group is hungry. You have a relation to them, so you share your food.
Exactly, because the biological need comes first. You cannot contract your way out of biology. But Dr. Sehaly argues that over centuries, our legal systems developed into a completely different operating system. He calls it money value sequencing.
And this one flows entirely differently.
Totally differently. It starts with a price, which leads to a contract, which establishes a property claim, requiring enforcement, leading to accumulation, then reinvestment, and finally, perpetual growth.
The great inversion.
The great inversion, exactly. We have built a legal architecture that fiercely protects symbolic claims like a corporate return on investment or debt schedules while actively dismantling living relations like public health or a stable climate.
I understand the contrast the paper is making, but look, what the author diagnoses as a pathology, I see as a vital development. Let's be deeply honest about what those early life sequence communities actually looked like in practice.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes, they were rooted in relationships and local ecology, but those relationships were often constrained by incredibly harsh, inflexible hierarchies. I mean, they were defined by absolute scarcity, patriarchal domination, and highly localized exclusionary customs.
Sure, but
if you were an outsider to the kinship network, you simply had no rights.
But they recognized their fundamental dependence on the life ground. They knew they couldn't survive if they destroyed their immediate environment.
Only locally. And often brutally. The mechanisms of legal abstraction, classification, measurement, alienability, formal contract, these are precisely the tools that allow strangers to cooperate.
At the expense of the local ecology, though.
But if I want to trade with someone across the globe or collaborate on a massive scientific project, I cannot rely on a shared life's ground or a kinship ritual. I need a contract. Relying purely on relational life sequencing for modern civilizational coordination is subjective, and frankly, it is entirely unscalable. Abstraction isn't a disease, it is an emancipation from the local.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. If a map represents a territory, legal abstraction is a map that deliberately leaves out the cliffs.
How so?
Well, let's look at what that abstraction actually does when it operates at a planetary scale. The paper draws heavily on the biologist Humberto Maturana to describe law as a domain of conserved coordination.
Let's pause there for a second, because that's a pretty dense phrase. For our listeners who aren't evolutionary biologists, what we're really saying with conserved coordination is that law is essentially a habit, right?
Basically, yes.
It's a society coordinating its behavior over and over by making the same distinctions until those distinctions become an automatic lived reality.
Exactly. Law brings forth a world by repeating distinctions. It repeatedly distinguishes the owner from the trespasser or the resource from the ecosystem. And over time, those repeated habits of abstraction have normalized a massive amount of structural violence.
Violence is a strong word there.
But it applies. When the law classifies a forest strictly as a resource, or when it classifies a human being purely as labor power, it commits what the sociologist Johann Galtung calls cultural violence. It legitimates harm by changing the language. It severs a living relationship from its context.
But how is classifying labor an act of violence?
Think about it this way. If I walk up and steal your wallet, the law acts instantly. The police are called, the courts are mobilized. That's direct violence, and the legal map sees it perfectly.
Sure.
But if a legal algorithm systematically prices an entire neighborhood out of the ability to buy groceries, or forces them to live next to a toxic discharge zone resulting in a decade of chronic asthma, the law calls that market efficiency. That is the structural violence Galtung is talking about.
I see the distinction.
Under Maturana's framework, for a society to be healthy, every effective party must be able to arise as a legitimate other. But when you abstract the river into a legally permitted discharge zone, the downstream community ceases to be a legitimate other. They become an externality. The law is hyper-vigilant to the stolen wallet, but totally blind to the poisoned neighborhood.
Look, I hear the critique, and the downstream effects are real. But let's go back to that concept of alienability, the idea of severing something from its context. Alienability and classification are exactly what free individuals from oppressive relational contexts.
By turning them into labor units?
Yes. You brought up treating human effort abstractly as labor power. Historically, before that abstraction, labor was extracted through whole person kinship obligations, serfdom, or outright slavery. Treating labor as a legally alienated contract where I sell you my time for a wage, but I explicitly do not sell you my personhood, creates freedom.
Okay, I can see a historical point. Breaking the bonds of serfdom was an essential evolution.
It creates mobility. I can leave. If we demand that all economic exchange return to relational, embeddedness, we risk returning to localized domination, where your boss isn't just your employer, but your patriarch or tribal leader.
Right, but the freedom you are describing today is often an illusion generated by the map. You say alienability frees the worker, but look at how that same mechanism applies to capital. When a corporation's legal personhood perfectly shields its shareholders from the ecological collapse it causes a networker's community, the legal map is actively protecting blindness.
Limited liability serves a purpose.
It separates the financial gain from the relational responsibility. How can a coordination system be considered an evolutionary success if it mathematically selects against the survival of its own biosphere? The law makes the corporation highly visible as a rights-bearing person, while the destroyed organism nitrilation is rendered entirely invisible.
It is a valid concern, but have you considered that without limited liability and corporate personhood, the pooling of capital required to build, say, the green energy grid, or to manufacture global vaccines would be mathematically impossible?
I think impossible is a stretch.
Not really. The scale of human need today requires massive capital concentration. The abstraction of the corporation is what allows us to aggregate resources to solve biological problems. You simply cannot fund a multi-billion-dollar semiconductor fab or a global logistics network through local sharing and community restraint. You need abstract vehicles.
But that capital pooling is currently governed entirely by the money value sequence. It prioritizes reinvestment and financial growth above all else, even above the biological problems it claims to solve. And this brings us to how the Great Inversion operates temporally.
Meaning how we buy in the future?
Exactly. It's not just about space and property. It's about time, specifically through debt and contract. In a money value sequenced world, contract law enforces formal agreement while completely blinding itself to the coercion of necessity.
What do you mean by the coercion of necessity?
Well, the law looks at a signature on a sub-minimum wage agreement or a predatory loan and says, this is freedom. This is mutual consent. It willfully ignores the fact that the worker signed it because the alternative was literal hunger. That is structural violence masquerading as a voluntary handshake.
I come at it from a different way.
Go ahead.
I look at that exact same signature on that exact same contract, and I see the engine of time-binding trust. Debt and contract are not colonizers of the future. They are the only mechanisms we have to bridge time reliably. If a society cannot make a credible promise about the future, it cannot build anything today.
But debt does colonize the future. Look at entire nations where public health and ecological repair are totally subordinated to paying off past monetary claims to distant creditors.
You critique contract law for ignoring life necessities, but think about the alternative. What happens if courts must constantly invalidate contracts based on subjective, retroactive evaluations of life necessities or systemic dependency?
We might actually prioritize human survival over profit margins.
No, what happens is legal certainty collapses entirely. And certainty is the bedrock of complex provisioning. Without legal certainty, no one lends capital to build a hospital. No one extends credit for agriculture. If every debt can be canceled because a judge decides it conflicts with the life ground, the cost of credit skyrockets globally.
And the investors lose money.
And the very people you want to protect are immediately locked out of the financial system entirely.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. Legal certainty is vital, but right now it operates as frozen harm.
Frozen harm?
Yes. Look at what the law chooses to make certain. When a family faces eviction, it is enforced rapidly and with absolute certainty by the state. The police show up, the door is padlocked, the property title is upheld. But that same family's fundamental human right to housing remains an unenforceable, vague aspiration.
That's an enforcement issue, though.
It's a structural issue. The legal system's certainty is just a measure of whose claims it values over whose lives. The debt collection is hyper-efficient. But the protection of the family's life capacity is treated as a secondary policy preference. Debt becomes pathological the moment it outranks the life conditions of the debtor.
But the eviction is enforced rapidly because the property title is clear and the procedure is clear. Property title is what prevents us from fighting a violent physical battle over who gets to sleep where every single night. The clarity of the rule, even if it results in tragic individual hardship, prevents systemic chaos. The law is a blunt instrument, I will grant you that. But it is reliable.
It is perfectly reliable at enforcing the Great Inversion. And this is exactly why Dr. Saley leans so heavily on the philosopher John McMurtry's value standard. McMurtry argues that we have to evaluate law not by its internal logical consistency or its procedural reliability, but by this singular metric. Does a law enable or disable life capacity?
And how exactly do we measure that?
Well, right now, we measure success almost exclusively through money value metrics, you know, GDP, corporate growth, property values, and we all know the paradox here.
The GDP paradox.
Right. GDP can rise steadily while public health plummets, soil fertility vanishes, and ecological stability collapses. When a catastrophic oil spill happens and post-disaster GDP spikes because we are suddenly spending billions of dollars on emergency cleanup of preventable pollution, Calling that growth is a profound cognitive failure.
So what's the alternative measurement?
Dr. Saley proposes what he calls a Wu-Wei legal transformation. The goal is to fundamentally re-nest monetary metrics underneath life value metrics. We need the legal system to measure things like nutrition, housing security, water access, and community trust as the primary indicators of a law's legitimacy.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. The moment you ask a legal system to base its judgments on life value metrics like community trust or emotional well-being, you are inviting deeply arbitrary governance.
But they aren't arbitrary.
They are highly subjective and incredibly susceptible to ideological capture. Who defines what flourishing is? Who defines community trust? Money value, for all its structural violence, offers a universal equivalent. It is legible. It is neutral across deeply divided societies.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because treating money as a neutral metric is exactly what allows structural violence to disguise itself as efficiency. Is clean water subjective? Is a breathable atmosphere an ideological preference?
Well, no. Obviously, clean water isn't subjective.
Right. We aren't asking courts to measure vague feelings. We are asking them to stop treating the destruction of a clean water aquifer as an acceptable externality of commerce.
It is a shared language, though. If you and I disagree fundamentally on religion or morality or the definition of a good life, we can still negotiate a price. We can still trade. Asking courts to measure, as the paper suggests, a more coherently inclusive range of thought and felt being turns judges into philosopher kings. It replaces objective, predictable administration with subjective moralizing. I find that prospect genuinely terrifying.
And I will concede that your fear of arbitrary governance is completely valid. The idea of judges acting as philosopher kings, dictating what constitutes a good life, is a terrifying prospect. But we have to recognize that the current system is already arbitrary. It just hides its ideology behind the math.
I wouldn't call it an ideology. It's a pragmatic tool.
A tool that prices out life. Look, the trade-offs required to maintain an industrial society, electricity, modern medicine, global agriculture, are incredibly complex. I agree with you there.
Right. And pricing mechanisms are how we navigate those vast trade-offs without central planners dictating every move.
But pricing mechanisms utterly fail when they encounter the absolute limits of the life ground. If a logging company buys the legal right to clear-cut an ancient forest, the price they pay does not account for the loss of the organism niche relations, the disrupted water cycles, or the cultural memory of the indigenous community that lived there.
But we have environmental regulations for that.
Measurement translates complex, irreplaceable life into a single, tradable quantity, and the law stamps it and says, this is a valid contract. The legal lineage has learned to conserve the distinction of property while totally forgetting the life that makes property possible in the first place.
I think you are underestimating how much the legal system has already learned and adapted. We aren't living in the 19th century. We have the EPA. We have labor laws. We have human rights tribunals. The system of legal abstraction is fully capable of internalizing these externalities. We can tax carbon. We can heavily fine polluters.
It's too slow, though.
We can do all of this without needing to undergo a total legal transformation that subordinates all property and contract rights. The tools to fix the machine are already inside the machine.
This is exactly where that concept of Wu-Wei legal transformation comes back in, because Dr. Saheli argues that simply tweaking regulations isn't enough if the underlying logic remains inverted.
So what does Wu-Wei transformation actually look like in practice? Because it sounds incredibly abstract.
It's essentially like acupuncture for the legal code. You don't rewrite the entire constitution with a sledgehammer, and you don't destroy contract law. Wu-Wei translates roughly to effortless action or minimum force.
Okay, minimum force. How?
It means finding the exact leverage points in the system to redirect its momentum. For example, changing the legal definition of fiduciary duty. Right now, corporate directors have a fiduciary duty to maximize shareholder return.
Right, financial primacy.
Exactly. If you use minimum force to legally redefine fiduciary duty so that it includes downstream water quality and community health, the massive trillion-dollar weight of corporate capital naturally redirects itself toward ecological repair rather than destruction. You use the tools of abstraction, but you re-nest them to serve the life ground.
I can appreciate the elegance of that analogy.
And frankly, redefining fiduciary duty is a much more practical proposition than dismantling the concept of alienability altogether.
Exactly. The goal of life-coherent jurisprudence is not to destroy law or to eliminate property and contract. The goal is to properly re-nest them. Money becomes life-coherent when it serves provisioning, not when it dictates value. Property becomes life-coherent when it is nested in stewardship.
And contract?
Contract becomes life-coherent when it reflects meaningful consent, not desperate dependency. The fundamental principle is lex secunda vitae. Law must remember that it is second to life. We have to cure this blindness through truth, naming, and structural repair, ensuring every being arises as a legitimate other.
And my summary is this. While I entirely agree that the legal system must build better, more sensitive feedback loops to address ecological and structural externalities, we must be incredibly careful. Dismantling the primacy of money value sequencing threatens the foundations of the modern world.
But that foundation is currently cracking.
The abstraction of law, the enforceability of contract, and the clarity of property rights are the vital, hard-won tools that allow a diverse, globalized humanity to cooperate at scale. If we undermine legal certainty in pursuit of a localized, relational life ground, we risk destroying the very mechanisms that pull millions out of poverty and coordinate our survival on a planetary scale. We cannot afford to romanticize the past.
I don't think either of us wants to romanticize the past. And despite our different lenses, we do have clear points of convergence here. Both of us seem to agree that the concept of legal innocence, this pervasive idea that a law is automatically just simply because it was validly enacted by a legislature, is a historical fallacy.
Absolutely. Slavery was validly enacted. Dispossession was validly enacted.
Right.
Yes, on that we are fully aligned. Legality does not equal morality. And I also recognize, as the paper forcefully points out, that the legal system must evolve to much better perceive the environmental costs and future generational risks that it currently externalizes. Legal certainty means nothing if the ecosystem collapses. We cannot have a functioning legal system on a dead planet.
Exactly. The complexity of our inherited legal lineages is immense. It leaves all of us with a profound question. Is our law destined to remain merely a memory of victorious power and abstract wealth, or can it truly be re-nested into the life ground as a practice of shared ecological repair?
It is a question that requires us to look very critically at the tools we use to build our civilization. Dr. Saheli's paper certainly offers profound depths for further exploration on that front.
It really does. It forces us to look back at that map of the city we talked about at the beginning. We have spent centuries perfecting the grid, sharpening the property lines, and accelerating the traffic along the highways. But we don't live on the map. We live in the territory. And if the map requires the destruction of the territory to remain accurate, it is the map that must change.
A very thought-provoking place to leave it.
Thank you for joining us on the debate.